court. Okay, so today is May 13th, and we're going to do mitzvah 411 to 414, Bezrat Hashem. So mitzvah 411 is that a witness who testifies in a trial for a capital crime should not speak in judgment. Did we not talk about this at all?
I wasn't here last week, so okay. I don't know.
No, we didn't. Okay. So basically it means you can serve both. You cannot be both a judge and a witness. So if you saw the crime, you can't judge it.
Oh.
Right? So if you happen to be a judge who was out there walking, or if in front of the Sanhedrin, all 71 of them, somebody kills somebody, right?
Wow.
And everybody saw it. You can't just say, done, we saw it, it's clear, he gets the guilty sentence, now kill him. Right? And we warned him, whatever. You can't. They're all witnesses. They can, none of them can serve as a judge.
Oh, we did mention that last
right?
time.
I thought we mentioned
that. But it's, so even if he doesn't give testimony, he says, should not speak out in the judgment trial regarding which he gives testimony. So could someone choose, you suppose, to be either a judge or a witness?
Not sure. I don't think so, because I think
if you are a witness,
that by
you're
you witnessing, it affects your judgment.
Sense. I was going to say, because you're sort of having
because
you go in with a preconceived.
It, right, and now you think you know.
Mm-hmm. And we all know how poor
eyewitness testimony
can be.
But a capital crime has to have two witnesses.
Has to have two witnesses and warning. And we're going to find out, let's see, is that here or is that in the next one? No, so I guess it's here. Yeah, it is here in 411. What's interesting, it has to have two witnesses, it has to have warning, it has to have recognition of warning, and you have to both see it. The two witnesses have to be together. So as it says in the last paragraph of this mitzvah, now Rabbi Moses ben Nachman of blessed memory explained the verse, he shall not be put to death by the mouth of one witness, as meaning another injunction, namely not to accept singular testimony in a capital case. Okay, so you can't just take one. This means, for example, if the witnesses saw the crime, one from this window and one from another window, far enough from the first so that those standing at the windows could not see each other, although both saw the criminal. This is explained in the first tractate of Machlokes, right? So if two people saw it, but they didn't know that there were two seeing it, I think I'm by myself, I'm watching it. Somebody else thinks they're by themselves, they're watching it. We don't see each other, but we both see the crime. We don't count as two witnesses.
That's weird.
Oh. Yeah.
Because that would seem like the least
biased. I would agree.
Think that'd be better.
I would think
like
so.
The two
I would agree.
Have to corroborate. Did we just see the same thing?
Yeah, no. I think so. I think there is something about that it has to be two together. So it's interesting to think about what does eyewitness testimony mean? Because if we do say it's so flawed, so then you really have two people who could be very flawed, as opposed to two people who say, "Yeah, I think that is what we saw," which also, in a way, could be flawed, but. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's the halacha, is that it can't be a person who sees it alone. It has to be people who see it together, two who see it together. But if you all see it together, if the judges all see it together, then they can't be judges. They can be witnesses, but not judges. So because you are supposed to turn it over and turn it over and try to figure out how could this person be exonerated. You're not allowed to pervert justice in order to do that, but you are supposed to try to figure out, is there any mitigating anything that could work here? So, it's interesting. I don't know, like in the Petraeus trial, today there was an article about it. That's not his name, Petraeus. No, it's not.
No,
it's I'm
not.
Thinking of the South African guy.
Pistorius.
Thank you. In that trial. So today in the New York Times, there's an article about how he's probably suffering from anxiety disorder. And
you mean because he throws up every 2 minutes in the courtroom?
Right. Well, not just that, but because his father was largely... All right, so his behavior in the courtroom suggests that he's suffering from anxiety disorder and that his upbringing suggests that he would legitimately have developed it since his father was largely absent, since his mother was very nervous and she slept with a firearm under her pillow. And anyway, he's raised in South Africa, so you don't...
I was going to say, that's pretty realistic.
Right. Right. So it's pretty realistic. So was that anxiety disorder, did it impact, does he his, have it? Did it impact on
his
what
behavior.
He did? Right, so I don't know if that counts, but that's the kind of idea as you are supposed to try to go through. Is there anything that can mitigate? Is there anything that can exonerate? You know, you gave warning, and he looks like he's accepted the warning, but is he deaf? You know, is that possible? Maybe he just looked your way. Mm-hmm. Or maybe he didn't hear the words. Maybe he just heard the sound of your voice, and so he didn't really hear the warning. Like, you just have to go through and try to figure it out. So, let's say you're the judge in that case. Let's say he's deaf. That's a good example, right? So, you're the judge, but the witness, so you saw it, you know, clearly. You gave warning. He looks like he acknowledged the warning, and you could just kill him right there. Done. Right? You're the witness and the judge all in one. No. You cannot be the judge. You can only be the witness. You have to testify, and the judges then can look and see if there's anything else. Was he deaf? You know. Okay, so and the root precept is what we wrote about in 409, Mitzvah 409, which is that capital cases are something very difficult, which require extremely great accuracy, and the community was commanded to save the person to be judged in every way on his behalf. That is his right due to him to save him. Although they are not to pervert justice to rescue him, perish the thought. As the sages of blessed memory interpreted, then the community shall judge and the community shall rescue, as much as to say that they need to cast about seeking his innocence, and if he has any merit for acquittal, they should save him, but if not, let him be put to death. So,
but this only applies when the temple's there, when the Sanhedrin's sitting.
Right, so the halacha of judgment this way only applies then. However, the concept applies now too.
So we believe, I didn't realize that Judaism believed in the death penalty.
Yeah, we do.
Oh.
It happened very rarely.
There were specified things for which a death penalty.
Yeah, there's
specified.
There's specified things. There's only certain things that say if you do this, you get the death penalty, and you can only get it. So first of all, it has to be one of those categories. And then it has to be that there's two witnesses.
And obviously
warn
both together.
With the right verse.
Okay.
So now that's for transgression of certain things. I mean,
murder. So they have to say, wait, do you realize if you kill that person, you will be transgressing Lo Tirzach, the verse that
don't
says, don't,
life.
Right, do not murder. And they have to say, yeah, I know, and then
bang.
Right, and then kill them. So with two witnesses there. So if there's two witnesses there, and they warn him, and he gets it. And then the witnesses are required to go to Beit Din and testify against him. It's not, there's no police. No police.
So really, the death penalty is so rare. Because,
exactly.
Right. I mean, how often
really,
are there
don't.
Two witnesses
together?
So we
do together? Believe in it, but we don't.
Right.
We believe in it, but we don't practice it.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So that's the idea, is that we don't actually do it. And it is considered, the situation is so ridiculously, you know, outlandish that it could all fall together. That we say that if a Beit Din would kill somebody once in 70 years, some people say once in seven, but once in 70 years,
it would be
called a bloody Beit Din.
Yeah.
That would be
frequent. That's how rare it is.
That's how rare it is that we actually put somebody to death. But if you read the Torah, it's death, 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 death all over
the
place.
I was going to say, there's lots of, right.
But that's to teach you how big a sin that thing is, not that we kill people all the time. So that's important to know, that sometimes the punishment is just there to show you the severity of what the transgression is. Because if you kill somebody without witnesses and without warning, God knows, you still get the severity of that punishment. It's actually better for
delivered
you.
In a different way.
Right. It's still delivered. It doesn't mean it'll necessarily be death. It might be. But it doesn't necessarily mean that. But it might mean other kinds of negative things that can have that same weight. And so we do understand it's better to be punished in this world by the Beit Din of this world than it is to have to be punished in the next. So much so that when somebody loses a monetary trial in front of the Beit Din, right? They're arguing about money, right? You owe me $1,000. No, I don't. And if you lose, you're supposed to make a kiddush. Right? Pay your $1,000 and make a kiddush.
Consider yourself.
I don't have that erroneous debt hanging on me.
Yeah.
That block has been removed. I have merited to pay my debts and to be clean. And now I'm thankful for that.
That's a good,
and
that's
I
a
celebrate
good
that. Right. So that we should feel that level of cleanness. So if we don't get that, you know, if the person never brought us a trial or it didn't work well in today's age, you're fighting with a painter. He painted your house. You don't think he did the fair work. And, you know, he happens to be a Jewish guy and you're not paying him and he says you should pay him or whatever it is. And you never figure it out. One of you is going to pay a heavy price, like, you know, for whatever it is.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So you'd rather have that be clean and know that you know.
Mm-hmm. That's an interesting.
Yeah.
I like that.
So that's why. So it doesn't necessarily apply because the temple's not standing, but it does apply. We are supposed to look for somebody's innocence. We are also supposed to have a justice system that punishes those who are guilty. So I don't know, like, what the halacha says on if the American justice system, or a justice system that's relatively fair, like America's, relatively fair, should have the death penalty or not. Is that up to us to decide as human beings, without, outside the, you know, parameters of the Torah, that we can have death penalty or not? We are supposed to set up courts to enforce the law. The seven mitzvot of Noach, and one of them is to not kill, right? So are we allowed to do that or not? I don't know what the halacha says on that. I'm sure somebody, you know, who knows more knows. But anyway, we are supposed to have fair courts that will uphold the law. And so we are obligated to do that today, and to make them fair. Okay. Mitzvah 4:12. To take no ransom to save a killer from his death sentence. Okay, so now, somebody extremely wealthy went through this entire process, right? They killed somebody, they had, there was witnesses, warnings, acknowledgement, trial, he's guilty, he's going to be killed, right? Now he says, I have multiple billions of dollars. I will endow all Jewish education in North America so that every single Jewish child can go for free if you don't kill me. Right? Can you take it? No, you cannot. Right? There is no matter what they promise, no matter how much money, you cannot buy your way out of a death sentence.
So an interesting corollary or something to this whole thing is something that's relevant today. If somebody who is morally, let's just say, corrupt or you know, does things that aren't right, offers to give money. Now, not to get themselves off, but just to give money, do you take their money?
Right,
is their
so that's
money?
A real question. So, of course, that's in the press right now.
Right,
what do we
that's
do,
what I was
right?
going to say. But I mean, it's certainly come up in the past as
it
well.
It has come up. And we also have to think about political correctness and where that plays in it, because I've thought about that, too, like with this whole Sterling
well, the
case.
With Sterling,
right?
But
okay,
yeah.
So
well,
with
Madoff.
Him.
And there
Madoff.
Was Madoff.
Okay, let's skip Madoff for a minute and go to Sterling. Sterling held views that we all agree are reprehensible.
Yeah,
he spoke to his girlfriend about them on a private phone call on his cell phone with his girlfriend.
Or, yeah, in his house or whatever.
Are we McCarthyists that
right.
we're really allowed to like go listening to phone calls and then decide if you could like
have those beliefs?
Right. Yeah, have right. those beliefs or mm-hmm. not? I mean, like, really, where do we? I'm not sure. Like,
I agree. It's very.
I really feel like
I'm
that's
conflicted.
Yeah,
I
mean, do I agree with the beliefs? Absolutely not. Is he a scum? Yeah. Okay. No. Fine.
But
is he allowed to have his opinions? Yes, I think so. Every person
and
is allowed
he,
to
and
have
is a person
them.
Allowed to. I mean, my gosh, what lengths do we go to? What lengths do we go to allow people to say really terrible things?
Right.
Not just their personal opinion, but really, really bad things.
Right.
I mean, you know, that, and it is reprehensible.
So we can't, I mean, just from this perspective, I think we can say it's freedom of speech. Freedom of speech doesn't mean we don't have to boycott him. We have freedom, too. Freedom
right.
of speech is a governmental thing.
Right.
Freedom of speech is he is permitted
thing.
To say that. Mm-hmm.
And it wasn't
right?
a governmental
I am
thing.
Permitted to say, I hate you, and I will never go to another one of your games, of anything that you own. And the owner of the club is allowed to say, actually, that's going to impact our yeah. bottom line so negatively that I choose as a business decision
well, and he
to
contractually,
kick you out.
And he contractually agreed to the right of the organization to kick him out.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's different. And
so
I
that's different.
And I don't
right.
think freedom of speech is there. And nevertheless, as individuals, we do have to wonder, like, where do we allow and what don't we allow? I mean, and we certainly get to choose if we want to shop in a place or not, or attend
which
a game
I,
or not.
I personally have made those choices.
Right,
oh,
which we
I
get
do.
To. So mm-hmm. a person gets to be a Holocaust denier if he wants to. Does he get to teach it as
at a public
professor,
institution?
Mm-hmm. That's a different question.
Right.
Does he get to believe it as a private individual?
How do you keep somebody...
Right.
Ready?
How do you do get to believe it as a private... Can you talk to somebody on your private phone? Nice. Maybe somebody's tapping it, but are you entitled to your opinion? I mean,
yes.
I think you are.
You
know?
Are.
Like,
I mean, the government clearly couldn't do anything about it. And
right.
I mean, legally, I think the league has the right to do it. That this is a they do. They legally have the right to do what they
okay.
did because of their contract
okay.
and stuff.
Right.
So,
okay.
so that's
and it has
it's not a government.
Do,
it's not
it
a
has
government.
Nothing to do with free speech.
No,
I mean,
it really doesn't.
No, you can say. You can say anybody who says sports is bad can't be the owner of a sports team. Anybody who has an opinion that we dislike can't be the owner of our sport, one of our sports teams.
Yeah.
So anybody who says blacks are bad, they don't get to, you know...
Have a sports team.
But here... So this past week, did you see on the news the people that threw the letters into people's yards in Five Points where I live?
No.
So I woke up last Saturday morning, went outside to get the newspaper, and there were two sealed envelopes in my front yard. Now, this is my front yard, so somebody did this at my property. And I bent down to pick up the envelope, and my neighbor yelled across the street, "Don't touch that envelope, Taya." And I was like, "What?" And then I saw the police. They were parked on the side of my house, and they came up, and they said, "Ma'am, don't touch that envelope." And I was like, "This is in my yard." Mm-hmm. I said, "Do these envelopes say the same thing? What is it?" And he said, "I believe they do." And I said, "You can take that one. This one's mine." So I took it in the house, and I read it, and it said the NIGGER down at, and it gave an exact address, needs to go back to the ghetto. There's no room in this area for N's and Jews.
Really?
And it was signed C period B period. So, and I sat there without a letter for the longest time, and I'm like, I know all my neighbors. And then I was like, I walked down the street because I wanted to address that address. It's an 81-year-old woman who's lived there since the 70s. She's black. And I came home and I said, "John, there's no way somebody in this neighborhood wrote this letter to us. This is someone outside the neighborhood. Something weird."
Well, there's something going on in Highlands, too.
They have the Hispanic thing. Right. It happened like a week later. But I guess it takes me back to the whole concept of, was I allowed to have that letter? Was I allowed to touch it and... You know,
of course you're allowed to.
Yeah,
it's
yours.
It's property.
Right, right. And it was interesting because the police officer clearly wanted me to give him both letters.
Why, though?
Well, because they probably wanted him for evidence.
They did.
I mean, it
sounds... They can still count it, but...
Well, but they probably didn't want you to touch it because there's evidence on it, possibly. I mean, you know.
I know.
So, legally, one thing, whether, you know... Mm.
Right, legally it's one different than what's smart. You know, there's two different things.
You know, so.
But I think the end of the story is that I believe it's a fix and flipper in our neighborhood who was trying to scare Miss Monica into selling.
Unbelievable!
Totally, because you know there are some sharks out there that are just terrible.
Unbelievable! That's terrible.
We had somebody in our neighborhood also who bought a house out from under an older person for like about a third of the market value.
And that's terrible.
Yeah, yeah, they just slipped in like a snake.
Right.
And talked to that person, said, "I see your aging is not so easy for you. I'll take care of it. I'll help you move. I'll help you find another place.
Yeah.
And I'll give you this straight up cash for what you have." Because they knew what the person bought it for. So for that person,
it would seem like a lot of money.
It seems like a lot of money.
But compared to what they could have
got, it was worth about a third of what they could get in the open market. Yeah. Yeah.
That's terrible.
Yeah. Yeah. Really sad. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So there are people who do that who know their market
and know somebody who's vulnerable.
Yeah.
And
they watch. I learned from this whole incident with that particular house what they do.
I don't know how to protect people like that if they don't have family or whatever that can sort of be watching out for them. It's
Our neighborhood got together and bought her a security system.
That's nice.
Yeah. So because she was scared.
I don't blame her.
She was living on Social Security. And
where do you live?
Five Points.
Wow.
We live right behind
Manuel
High School.
Wow. You should write an article for H.com.
That's a good story.
Yeah, you should.
Really?
You should write it
well, that the community, that the community
rallied
basically.
Around this woman.
Yeah. Well, and I think in
that
addition to
that,
together, I mean, you
that
need
people
to
reach out.
Know that she needs to know that you are there and that if something happens that she can turn to you because...
She knows. I mean, we've taken her dinner and, you know, I mean, she's...
Okay, so that's important.
She's so darling.
Yeah. I think that's important.
People are really scum. Anyway, back to the point. So this is...
So this is saying you cannot...
This says you can't ransom yourself or somebody else from a...
Or somebody else.
That's what I said. Or somebody else from the penalty that you were... That was... You know, that you were... That you got.
So even if the blood relative, who's the avenger...
Right. Says
even if they say...
It's okay.
A, I'll take the money. You know, it's fine.
Like, okay.
I have
even
debts.
Right.
I have debts. I'll take the $1 million they're offering me. Let them off. Right.
Won't work.
No, you can't. It's not. You can't. There's
buy
no way.
Your way out of it. So, but then that does get to the moral issue of where we sort of digressed a bit.
Right.
Which is, there was an interesting article in the Jewish News this week about that as well with respect to Sterling. About whether or not the organizations in L.A. would take his money.
Right.
And
Should. So one of them returned it, right? I forgot.
Well, and they were talking about
taking his money.
And you know, it's an ethical issue too, because when money's given for charity, it helps people that have no connection. This is helping somebody who has a connection to the crime, but charity money doesn't have any connection. But is the money not clean?
But how do you do like a once removed money? Because I mean, his money is in like foundations and things like that. So I mean, maybe that's
still
that's
money.
The work.
Okay, so I think it's really quite. I mean, so that's the crescent that we're grappling with Sterling. Is that's different than this,
right?
So what he's trying to do is, I mean, with his money, he's trying to buy some public opinion.
Well, he wants publicity for his charitable acts,
right.
which adds a whole nother layer.
A lot of people do. A lot of people give money. That's why they put their name on something. That's why it's the X Museum or the YJCC or the
whatever,
you know, Q School, whatever it is. That people put their names on things. They like to have a little publicity for the charity that they've given, whether it's for them or a parent or whoever they're naming it after. Mm-hmm. That is a thing. So can you do that yourself? Yes, you can. If you want to, you could say this is the Beulah Home for the Aged. Right, and it can be called that.
Very
no
nice.
Problem.
Nice.
I could do that if I want to. Right?
Okay.
So that's fine. Now, what if I hate old people? I think they're disgusting and creepy, and they all really, at 70, should kill themselves.
Oh, nice.
But because I hold that opinion, and I want to look good in the eyes of the community, so I found the Beulah Home for the Aged. People should know.
But really?
Right. Really, I think they should all die. I'm not telling the nurses in that home to kill them. I'm just setting up the home. Because I want people to see Elisa Beulah loves the aged. But really, my opinion is blah. Right? So that's the Sterling case.
Pretty much, yeah.
He gave to the NAACP.
Sure, it was about to get an award.
Right.
Yeah.
But
his second award,
it was
by the way,
to mitigate his opinion that black people are blech. That's what he was doing. That's the whole point of giving.
Or
to the,
because
that's
he
exactly
just thought that
is.
Was a PC thing, and so he was trying to look.
No,
at the
no, he could have done what he could have given it to a million different organizations.
Well, yeah,
he gave it to the NAACP because he didn't like black people.
I guess you're probably right.
Because he wanted to, you know, look good in the area where he knew he looked bad. So he was trying to do that. So can they? Is it ethical for them to take that money? I think it is. I really do.
Well, I almost am one of these people that sort of like do it because it's even like, why not? I'll take money.
I don't have a problem with that.
And I've said
now,
that before.
If he earned the money by exploiting black people, where I would say.
Or which gets to, like, then you get to the Madoff thing.
Right. Yeah.
If you
run the Head Start program nationally and you pilfered funds from it.
Right.
Right. And you gave that money to the NAACP to look good. That's when the NAACP has to return it and say, no.
I'm not taking the fruits of that money.
That's tainted money. Money that was stolen, money that hurt other people. But money that's just to make an opinion better of you, I say take it.
Yeah,
no, that's not tainted
sort of
money. You didn't get it by ill means.
Right.
You know, so you I think you could take it, but
And
everybody can still know you're a creep. You're a creep, and we'll take your money.
Right.
Because we have
money
programs
is money
to run.
And use it for programs against racism.
That's right. Right. I think that's okay.
To combat racism.
I wouldn't return it.
No.
I wouldn't give the guy an award for his. But, I wouldn't
well,
return
I think they aren't.
That
give him any more awards either, but there you go.
No, they're not giving him any more awards.
No, he's creepy.
But they are returning the money.
Some were and some weren't, apparently.
Yeah.
I don't know.
So I don't think
it's funny, when I first looked at him on TV when the whole first thing started, I looked at him and I thought, oh God, I hope he's not Jewish.
Yeah.
And I looked at him, I just looked at him, and I don't know what it was about, and I mean, it wasn't any, you know, the next thing I heard, and I was like,
why?
Yeah.
What were you thinking? Unbrace yourself. Yeah, really sad. Such a chilul Hashem. It really is. We have a lot of work to do. Okay. Anyway, so that is this mitzvah to not take a ransom to save a killer from his death
sentence.
Which
is logical.
And it makes total logic, and that's exactly what he says. The root reason for this precept is known, evident, for if the rulers of the land were permitted to take ransom from the hand of a killer, the result would be that whoever is bigger than his fellow man and richer than he is will kill him if his anger flares up toward him and will give his ransom.
It's the whole thing about kings.
Right.
They're above the law.
Right.
I mean, you know, if money gives you the ability to be above the law, you're above the law.
Right. So that's what they say. Nobody's above the law, no matter how much they have, no matter where they're giving it, no matter what they do. Everybody has to take their punishment. Okay. Now, what about if you killed by mistake? Mitzvah 4:13. to take no ransom from someone sentenced to banishment to free him from it, right? You have to send somebody into exile, which is one of those irmaklats, one of those...
killed inadvertently.
What do you say, irmaklat is city of refuge. So if you're going to... If you've been sent to a city of refuge because you killed by mistake, right, and that's the law, we talked about it last week, luckily, you're driving along, you happen to be following the rules, right, you stop at a... You're planning on stopping in the red light. There's black ice. You didn't see it. You skid. You smack into another car. You kill somebody. You kill somebody inadvertently, right? So, or for whatever it is, whatever reason it is, or you didn't. I think that actually doesn't count because it's completely inadvertent and you were following the rules. But let's say you were texting and you did that, right?
There you go. So now you didn't mean to kill somebody.
You did not mean at all to kill somebody, but
that was the consequence of your actions.
So then you have to go to a city of refuge. Right, because their relative is allowed to kill you back. And so you have to save your life. There's no option. You have to go to a city of refuge until the Kohen Gadol dies. That's your sentence, however long, that's your term, however long that is that he lives. And you cannot buy your way out of it. You can't give any ransom.
The root reason is the same as the one above, so there's no need to elaborate.
Right.
That's the end of it.
Right. That's it.
But what's interesting about this is that it really delineates the whole concept of redeeming captives, because it's the Jewish way to redeem a captive.
Pidyon shvuyim, right. Mm-hmm.
And a captive.
But this is
that's interesting.
It's different.
You're right. No, you're right. I didn't think about that. You're right. Because that is, you would think, okay, so we can, if somebody's trapped somewhere, we can use money to release them. And that is a value that we have as Jews, is to gather money to help somebody become released.
But this is a life that's different.
But there's, you know, categories.
Right.
Now.
But yeah. This is saying, no, you're not, trapped. Here you're saying you're not a captive.
Sorry, I was going to say,
you are
trapped by your own actions.
Yeah, you're trapped by your own actions, and there's no release.
Yeah, that's a different deal.
So one thing nice if pirates get you.
Yeah, we have, laws, that really delineate, flesh out the whole idea. Mm-hmm.
But it is interesting because how does that sort of...
Captivity.
But how does that... mesh with no negotiating with terrorists, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In other words, let's say these unfortunate poor girls that were kidnapped from their school,
they just sent an Israeli team over there.
Oh, did they?
No, they did send one, finally.
Yes, I heard that this morning.
Good, a whole month later.
Yeah. Well, the Nigerian government wouldn't take any help.
They're
apparently,
ridiculous.
Beginning day one, both the British and the Americans tried to say, let us help you. And they were like, no, we got it. I think, whatever. But it is sort of an issue. I mean, and it's come up in a lot of other contexts about negotiating for the return.
Yes.
It's an issue thing with Israeli government.
It's an issue for redeeming captives, actually. And I don't know all the halachas, but it's definitely around that. They definitely talk about it. Can you or can't you? And certainly it did increase the kidnapping at certain periods of time when pirates understood that if you catch a Jew on a boat,
they will.
When you bring that Jew to a port city, the Jews
of
that city will pay and ransom that. So Jews are valuable. So on the one hand, it kept Jews alive.
On the other hand, it increased the likelihood they would be taken.
Right. So it kept them alive. So if you're taking over a boat, you'll kill the inconvenient passengers but keep the Jews because they're worth money.
Right.
So on the one hand, it keeps them alive.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, you might just catch a boat to see if there's any Jews on it
and
just take the Jews because they're worth money, right?
Yeah.
So, and there's that classic story in the Middle Ages of how the rabbis got to North Africa, right? Because the rabbinic center in 800-900 was still Babylonia after the exile from the Second Temple. And that's where everything was. And all letters, all halacha queries were sent there. And it could take a whole year for the turnaround until the letter got there and got back, right? So as people started to spread throughout Europe and Northern Africa, they really needed rabbis, but they didn't have. So there is the story, whether it's apocryphal, whether this exact thing happened or something similar happened, but there is the famous story of the four rabbis, Rosh Yeshivas, from Babylonia, sent out to go collect money for their yeshivas. That's what they do.
I was going to say
still do. Honored, time-honored tradition. Out they
going
go,
back to the
captured
start of time.
By pirates,
right.
Brought to some North African port city, where the Jews say, sure, we'll redeem you, but if we redeem you, you're ours. We need you. You can't go back. We're buying you. You have to promise to stay. So, and that's how the rabbis got, that's how they got rabbis.
Sounds like a plausible story.
Right, a little closer by. So, right. Okay, so anyway, that's clear that we don't redeem.
Look at that, we finished
another
book.
Yes, we finished this book. So it's interesting just to hear the rhyme here. Nishlam b'sefer b'midbar Sinai tihila l'meir einai. Right, so we finished the book of, so b'midbar is the name of the book, right? But it's really the name of that parsha, the second name, because we know each parsha is named after the first important word in the parsha. So here, then, it's really b'midbar Sinai in the desert of Sinai, in the Sinai desert. So b'midbar Sinai, and the reason why he adds in Sinai is because it rhymes with einai, my eyes. Right, so we have finished the book of In the Sinai Desert. It is a praise to the one who enlightens my eyes. So he translated over here in English, so in a way that it would still rhyme. Ended is the book of Numbers. Praise God the wise. See, that's not in there.
Right, mm-hmm. Right.
Who has bestowed the light of wisdom upon my eyes. But he did it so it would rhyme.
It does
in Hebrew. Yeah, yeah. So, and it's just interesting. Let's look at the note here. Well, the first line of the Hebrew couplet translated freely here with Podoklis is found in all four manuscripts and the first edition. The second occurs only in the second manuscripts, which is in the Vatican. The third and fourth have it only in the first line, and the first, oldest manuscript, continues after it, Baruch Hashem, really, because that rhymes too, the I of the end of it. It's just interesting to see that poetry. Okay, so we have finished this book. Now, before we start the book of Deuteronomy, Devarim, he gives a little introduction, which I don't remember him doing.
I don't remember either.
In the other ones, right? So here's a little introduction, and he quotes the Ramban, which I did not bring and probably should have, but this is just a piece of what the Ramban says. So I'll just read this out loud. Rabbi Moses ben Nachman, the Ramban of blessed memory, wrote, "The nature of this book of Scripture is known, that it is a restatement of the Torah. It's a Mishnah Torah. Moses, our master, peace abide with him, reviews in it for the generation that is to enter the land of Israel most of the Torah's precepts that the Israelites need to know. He adjures them about them with a great many admonitions and cautions them greatly about the punishments. At times he adds an explanation about some of them. Yet about all the religious duties of the Kohanim, he neither speaks nor adds any admonition, for the Kohanim were alert, zrizim, so, or quick. They paid close attention, so they didn't need any reminders. In addition, he adds in this book a few precepts that were not mentioned previously at all, such as levirate marriage, the law for one who gives his bride an evil name, the law of divorcing a woman, and scheming witnesses, and others. There's no doubt that all were imparted to Moses on Sinai or in the tent of meeting in the first year. For on the plains of Moab, nothing new is imparted to him other than the words of the covenant, as is explained there. For this reason, it is not stated in this book, and the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, command the Israelites, or speak to the Israelites and say to them this and this precept. Thus far his word." So here's the end of the quotation. So he's saying, all the halachas were given in the first year. This book is from the 40th year, right? They're in the desert for 40 years. This book is the 5 weeks before, from when he knows he's going to die until he dies. So it's his review of the whole thing. But there are new halachas. In fact, there's quite a few new halachas in this book. So what's up with that? So the Ramban says that all the halachas were given in the first year, just Moshe decided not to reveal them until the 40th year, which is why you will not find in this book the sentence, and there's two main sentences that are used regularly, and the Lord spoke to Moses saying, command the Israelites,
right?
Or speak to the Israelites. So in Hebrew, that's right. We don't see, I'll read it, let's see. Tzav et b'nei Israel, we don't see that. Or Vayidaber Hashem el Moshe le'mor. Right, we don't see that kind of language. Or daber al bnei Yisrael v'yamar ta aleihem. We don't see that clear language. I'm telling you this, so you should tell them that. We don't see that because now he has already been told this earlier, and now this is when he's choosing to reveal it. Okay. Mm-hmm. That should bother you.
Mm-hmm.
Why does it bother you?
Well, because is that really Moses' decision to hold on to that.
Is a Navi actually allowed to decide when he wants to say what? It seems no. It's an Iser D'oraisa. If a Navi is told something,
he's supposed to
tell the children of Israel that.
He's supposed to
He has to say it. It's not up to him when he gets to say it, right? So the Ramban is saying he got to pick, and then he says it later. The Radvaz, who I don't know who he is, I only listen to the lecture of Rabbi Shlomo Rosner, who's fabulous, but he, you know, learns, he knows much more than I do, so he looked up the Radvaz. So there is a clear machloket on this. There's a real argument. Was he able to do this or not? What's going on here? Did he, in fact, never say it, and now, because he made a choice, he's saying it now? Or did he, in fact, say it earlier, and he's just elaborating on it now, or reminding? Or there's also the concept, which we'll see in just a minute. Well, I'll read the sentence first, this paragraph first, next paragraph. As to the fact that these certain precepts were not mentioned in the first books, like the other precepts, do not wonder about the matter. Since the sages of blessed memory said in many instances, there is no earlier and later in the Torah. Right? There's no chronological order. Right? So, and then we'll see another thing in a minute. So, it could be that this is just when he's saying it. Nevertheless, we don't see the language of, and God said, so therefore say. So it still could make you wonder, so what's going on with this? So he's saying, don't wonder. But this is a clear machloket. Did he say it earlier and he's just reminding us now? Did he not say it? And what's going on? So the Radvaz's answer is, we don't actually know. We can't ask why it's revealed here or why God, because God's the one who wrote the book. This isn't Moses' book, although there's also some question about that. About this final one. But basically, we can ask what we learn from this, but not why he chose to do it that way, right? Because we can't, and it's not that we can't ask the question. Of course, we can ask the question. There's no questions we're not allowed to ask, but we can't really understand an answer. We're not going to know why God, what was God thinking, right? That's the question. We don't know what God's thinking. We can, however, ask, what can we learn from this, or what maybe does that impart to us? How could we deal with this information in our lives? What does that mean? How does that impact our lives, but we can't necessarily understand what was God thinking.
But aren't there like certain lessons you have to learn in context? I mean, there's certain things I'm teaching Penn now that I wouldn't have taught her when she was 3 years old.
Right.
So.
Right. So could it maybe be that? That's a possibility, right? So there's lots of different questions. Yeah. But let's look at now what the Sefer Chinuch says, the author. How he sort of answers it. He doesn't really, but it's an interesting answer. The root reason for this matter, it would seem, is that the Torah embraces all the wisdoms. Apart from the plain meaning of its sweet themes and the mighty foundations of its precepts. And perhaps on this account it is necessary that its sections and letters should be located where they are, all being precisely arranged by the divine master of wisdom, blessed is he. This is an adequate reason. So he's saying it could be Kabbalistic. Mm-hmm. Who knows? Mm-hmm. We have the main reason, like you can see it on the pshat level, on the simple level. It says do this and don't do that, and that's why it's arranged, but he says, actually, the Torah has lots of things going on, and we don't know all the things that are going on. So, yes, there's stories and there's context, and things are out of context, too, and we might say, that doesn't make any sense. Why is it out of context? And yet, the more you turn it over and the more you turn it over, the more you're going to learn, and it does have to speak to all the generations, including generations of people who have computers, who are able to, whatever, some people write off the codes, some people think the codes are very interesting. You couldn't have found those codes without computers. Like, anyway, there's layers and layers and layers, and the more we learn, the more we find. And it can only be that way if it's arranged in a way that allows that to happen. So it's possible that it's arranged this way just to make it so that, just so that God knows what he's doing, and we don't, and we could just say, oh, that's enough to know. That God is in charge. He did arrange it, and that's also we can just...
Well, there's certainly lots of other things that don't make any sense. So.
Right.
Would you say that Devarim, though, being the last book, is more or less, I mean, if you look at it as a whole, is a review?
Well, that's why it's called the Mishnah Torah. The review of the Torah. Mishnah Torah means review of the Torah.
It's a review of the whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, Moses in the final years, you know, here's a crash course, guys, in what I've been talking
about. That is what it is. It reviews everything except for the laws of the Mishkan, offerings, and Kohanim. It does not review that.
Right.
Which is a big chunk, as we know.
Right.
But so it doesn't review that section. Anything about the Mishkan or the offerings or the Kohanim, that's not part of the review, because we understand that the leaders should know that already, right? Those who did not participate in the sin of the golden calf, who got the leadership role because of it, they know their rules and they can stick with them. But for the rest of us, we need the review. So it is considered
so it's the Mishkan?
Mishkan Korbanot Kohanim.
Right. Right.
Right, so how to build it,
right.
how to behave
how to
in
the sacrifices,
it,
right.
how to make the garments,
who's supposed to do it, right.
who's supposed to do what.
Yeah, that was really the domain of the Levites of the Kohanim
right.
anyway, which is a whole separate thing. You know, they're really not part of the people. That's kind of their issue. Well, this is more or less for
right. So this is for the
Israel.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Right. So this is for the. For those who, you can divide it into those who participated and those who didn't participate in the sin of the golden calf.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Those who did not participate don't need the review. So it's interesting to think about also what sin does to our minds, you know, and our ability to understand. I mean, in learning Kabbalah, in learning anything, but certainly in learning Kabbalah, you can't really learn it unless you keep Torah and Mitzvahs. You know, you can study it, but it won't click mm-hmm. unless you've created the vessel in your body and in your life of halacha. You can't hold it properly. You won't get the same insights. It won't click in the same way. It'll just be an academic study. Mm-hmm. So the same thing with other things. There's all kinds of things that don't click unless you've created the network for understanding that the mitzvot create in your brain and life. So that's what this is saying, is that those people who engaged in this huge aveira, even though they got forgiveness for it, they need the review. They need the review. Right?
Don't
their
we
minds,
all, don't
they're
we
not
all.
Zaris. Yeah. So, yeah, it's an interesting thing. Okay. With that in mind, we will do the first mitzvah of this new book. There's only two mitzvot in the Parsha of Devarim, so we're just going to do the first one, which is not to appoint any judge who is unlearned in the Torah, even if he's generally learned. So no smart guys who don't know Torah. No nice guys who don't know Torah. No well-connected guys who don't know Torah. No rich guys who don't know Torah. Right? You can't just pick because he's your relative, because you like him, because he has good midos. Right? But he doesn't know Torah. So that makes total sense. You know, he's a professor of law, but he doesn't know Torah. He can't. We are not allowed to appoint him as a judge because he doesn't know Torah. Torah is different than secular law, and it makes a difference. You apply it differently, and if you don't know it, you can't possibly be a judge and actually apply the Jewish law appropriately. So let's just read what it says: the great Beit Din, or the exilarch being the one who's in charge of the communities of exile. So this is whether we have the Beit HaMikdash or we don't have the Beit HaMikdash. Both of them are constrained not to appoint a justice to judge the people who has not learned the wisdom of the Torah and the clarification of its fair and righteous ordinances. If he has many noble qualities, even if he has many noble qualities, since he is not knowledgeable and expert in the wisdom of the Torah, it's not right to appoint him as a judge. About this it was stated, you shall not respect persons in judgment. So this is interesting, because this pasuk usually means in judgment, meaning you as the judge shall not give more respect to one party than the other, right? You have a rich person and a poor person in front of you.
They're equal.
Mm-hmm.
Equal before
right.
the law.
You have an ugly person
right.
and a pretty person before you. Equal, right? So you're not, but it also means in terms of, it's not just the people who are in front of you, but actually also who you appoint to judge. It's the same. That verse applies to them also. Shall not respect person in judgment. This means the official appointed to assign judges. In other words, this injunction is given to him. Our sages of blessed memory taught further, perhaps you would say this man is handsome or strong or wealthy or he knows every language. I will appoint him to judge. It is therefore stated, you shall not respect persons, for he will be found declaring the guilty innocent and the innocent guilty, not because he's wicked, but because he doesn't know the law, right? The root reason is obvious for everyone. So now, let's see how this... So the precept applies in every place and every time. If someone transgressed this and appointed a judge who is not a wise scholar because of his wealth or of fine qualities or out of affection for him or on account of the eminence of his relatives, so narcissistic reasons, right, he would violate this negative precept and his punishment would be very great because every penalty for false judgments which that judge would give out because of his lack of knowledge will be due to him since he was the cause. So this applies to women too. Because if we're in the position where we can appoint a judge, it happens sometimes, right? So
judges.
Not women judges.
No, not women judges.
Women who can appoint it. So let's say I'm in 2014, and happen to be on the board of an Orthodox school that allows women to be on the board of it, because not all of them do. But let's just say, right? And so
For example,
I vote that the Beit Din should be these three people. And one of the guys is wealthy, and I know he's for sure not taking bribes. That's been a problem in the community, is that the judges take bribes. So I want to make sure that our Beit Din is wealthy so that no bribe will speak to them, right? So we appoint somebody who's wealthy, but isn't that learned, but he really is wealthy. So, and he's a really nice guy, right? And I vote for him. I would be transgressing this today, because if he does know Torah, he can't be the judge. Right? So it doesn't matter. Even if I have the good reason, we need to eradicate the bribery that's been going on with our judges, right? So I appoint somebody who's wealthy so he won't be susceptible to bribes. Then I transgress this because he has to know Torah. So it's possible that it could apply to a woman today if she's in that type of a leadership position that she could be appointing. She can't be a judge, but she could appoint. So this applies to her. Now, it's interesting... what it says, the sages said about someone who appoints a judge. So that would, you would think that would be enough, right? You could end it, right? Since he's the cause.
Right.
That should be the end. And usually we have, this precept applies, that's usually the last paragraph.
Right. Right. Now we have an extra one.
Now we have an extra two paragraphs, right? It's part of this precept, too, as it would seem that whomever the members of the community choose, that he should appoint officials over them for any purpose, he should give all his watchful concern and all his thought to appoint among them those who are fit and good for that position which the community needs, and he should quail? I don't know that verb.
Quail.
Before
quail,
no man
cower.
To appoint someone unfit. So, okay, so now it's saying this is not just about judges. This applies to other leadership positions. Who should be running the federation? Who should be running the shul? Who should be running our tzedakah fund? Who should be running different things that we have in the community? Should it be people that don't know halacha? You know, maybe it's our job as people who appoint them to make sure that they are the right person for the job. And it applies. So that's what that's saying. That's what this is saying. So let's just listen to the language again. It's part of this precept too, as it would seem, that whomever the members of the community choose, that he should appoint officials over them for any purpose, he should give all his watchful concern and all his thoughts to appoint those among them who are fit and good for that position which the community needs. And he should quail before no man to appoint someone unfit. So we should not be appointing people for other reasons other than their fitness for the job. Right. So that's a big deal. Okay. Whatever that is.
I think it's mine. I'm ignoring it.
That's okay. We're ignoring it. Right. Yeah. The sage has said about someone who appoints a judge who is not suitable, it is as though... So now we're going to get extra, right? It is as though he erected a pillar for idol worship, of which it is stated, you shall not set up for yourself a pillar. If it is a locality that contains Torah scholars, they said it is as if he had planted an Asherah. So that's two different levels. An Asherah tree is an Avodah Zarah tree. So on the one hand, one is setting up a pillar, which is something that no matter how much you water it, it won't grow. Right?
And the other is a forbidden
tree. Is something that will grow, right? So that's even worse. So let's say you're in a community without Torah scholars, but there's somebody who knows more halacha than... you find the best person, right, that's most appropriate. But let's say you didn't find the best person. That's like putting up a matzeva. That's for Avodah Zarah. That's bad. That's erecting a bad thing in the midst of your community. But if there are Torah scholars and you didn't choose the right person...
It's even worse.
Even worse, because that can get totally out of hand. Not only does that pervert judgment or pervert the execution of proper Jewish things in your community, but it grows, right? It's like planting that tree, because it also creates the perversion of respect for those who know more Torah.
I think the thing that I would struggle with that is, like, I think about politicians who, there are some politicians that are just really good people, persons, and they're able to get their message across and they're articulate, and then they surround themselves with advisors.
Right. So it says specifically, can you appoint an Am Haaretz?
Foolish person.
Foolish person. Not foolish. It's an unlearned person.
Unlearned. Yeah.
Who knows he's an Am Haaretz? He's a really good person. He will turn every single question up to the Gadol Hador, to the wisest person of the generation. Can you do that? No.
No.
You cannot. Because what if he doesn't? What if he finally thinks, oh, I've asked this question 16 times.
I know the answer, right?
But he doesn't know that one piece of information, or he doesn't even ask the question properly. You know, I have to learn how to ask questions, too. I told this story before. I remember when Avi first started Metro, he was 18, right? And he starts the beginning of the semester, and it's Rosh Hashanah. There's a test, right?
Yeah.
So I said, you've got to speak to your professor before the test.
And let him know.
So he comes back, and I said, tell him that, can you take the test a different day? So he came back, and he said no. I said, how'd you say? He said, can I take the test on a different day?
I was like, no,
you got to give him the reason.
That's how you ask the question. You have to say, professor, I notice you have a test scheduled in a week, which is on Rosh Hashanah, our new year, a day that I'm not permitted to come to school or write anything. Would it be all right if I planned for that test before or after? Could I make an arrangement with you to take that test on a different day due to the fact that I have this religious holiday? Then you have to learn how to ask a question. You can't say, can I take the test on a different day?
Of course, the teacher's going to say no. What did you think?
So, right. So, but an Am Ha'aretz, and in a way, that he was an Am Ha'aretz.
He didn't
understand the importance of the details of the question.
Doesn't know how to ask the question.
Right. Yeah. So you have so an Am Ha'aretz wouldn't know which details even to convey to the Gadol Hador. In asking the question. So you do have to have that, even if you have advisors around you. So I think it's probably a little bit different in politicians, because if they do work as teams, nevertheless, if you pick somebody who's relatively foolish or has wrong values, even if they're a great orator and they have people around them, they might make a stupid mistake or their values will take them in a different direction. So it does make a difference. Let's see. I want to continue with this interesting... Well, let's read this paragraph. Starting from the middle. And they said, furthermore, that whoever appoints a judge on account of his wealth, about it, it is stated, you shall not make to be with me gods of silver and gods of gold. So that's also the wrong reason. So these are all different levels of Avodah Zarah. So we're saying if you appoint somebody just because they have money, also, big problem. They went on further at length about this theme and said that if a judge gave money in order to be appointed judge, it is forbidden to stand in respect before him. So you can't even treat him like a judge at all. You can't even stand for him when he walks in the room, let alone bring a case in front of him. And his honor is to be greatly disparaged. And they said of him that the tunic in which he robes himself should be in your eyes as the pack saddle of a donkey.
That's pretty low.
Well, it was the way of early Torah scholars that they would flee from any appointment as judges unless it was an instance where there was none greater than they. So, but let's go a little further. So, not only does the person have to have Torah knowledge, but they also have to be a good person. They do. Because you can't respect somebody. So you could be very learned, but if you're not a mensch, you can't be appointed a judge. Because you don't want the litigants to say, oh, really? You're rendering judgment on us. And look at you. Perhaps you should get your own house in order before you go telling us what the halacha is, right?
Well, for sure. Look at how we judge or evaluate... Look at people in positions of authority.
That's right.
I mean, that it's sort of like human nature.
Right, it is human nature. Right. So while you for sure can't appoint somebody who's not a Torah scholar, you also cannot appoint somebody who's not a mensch.
It's to be a
they
good
have
character.
To have their midos. Yeah, they do have to have good character.
I can't imagine those don't go hand in hand.
They sometimes don't. They sometimes don't,
absolutely.
Right.
Yeah,
so you definitely have to make sure. I mean, it is possible to learn. And people are people. So it's possible to learn because you want to be the coolest. And it's really cool to know a lot. Right? So
Or sometimes, if you talked about it, people take their learning to a level that's past learning and to the point of excessive extremism.
Right.
And
right.
they behave in a way towards other people that's not at all Torah-like.
Right. Right, so it's possible. So that's why you do have to be careful that person has good midot as well. Right, they have to have what they call alamilas. Let me just tell you what those alamilas are quickly. It's not alamilas, not all the good qualities, but it says in the Rambam in Sanhedrin, Perek Bet, that those who are appointed to courts of 71 and 23 have to have all the good qualities, which we'll go into in a minute. In addition to they have to know witchcraft and astrology and all that different types of idol worship, because they will. They have to be knowledgeable.
Right. They have to guard against it.
They have to guard against it, but they also have to know when somebody brings something before them, they have to be knowledgeable about what they're talking about. They can't not know, is this legitimate or is this not legitimate? I'm not really sure. Like, does this qualify as witchcraft or not? No, they have to know. So they have to know all those things. In addition to what judges of three, so a regular Beit Din of just three, they do not have to know all the upper level stuff, but they do, all judges, whether they're 3 or 23 or 71 judges on a court, have to have wisdom, fear, humility, hatred of money, which means they should not be slaves to it at least, but hatred of money, ahavat emet, the love of truth, Ahavat habriyot lahen, which means they have to love other creatures for them, meaning other creatures have to see that in them, right? Uba'alei shem tov, and they have to have a good name. So the last two really are dependent on others. They have to behave in a way that others like them. That's the midah that the person has to have, meaning they have to behave. It's not even dependent. It's dependent on how they act. But there is a litmus test. There's no litmus test for how smart are you, how much do you fear Hashem, how humble are you, how much do you hate money. How can you tell that? But the last two, there is a litmus test. It depends on what people think about you. If people feel loved by you, you have ahavat briyot, meaning they feel the respect because you're the kind of person that respects others, then that counts, right? And if you have a good name, what's your name in the community? You know, are you known as a rat? Or are you known as a good person? Oh, that's so-and-so. They're really nice. They always have guests. They always reach out. They always, if somebody needs something, they can always go to them, right? So they have to be that kind of a person that everybody know, that they know, not just that they're good in their own home. They have
to be good enough to be good.
Yeah. Right? Those are the seven qualities that are necessary for a judge, in addition to Torah knowledge. So once he knows the halacha, he then also has to be wise and have trepidation, fear of Hashem, and be humble, and hate money, and love the truth, and have love of other creatures, and they know about it, and he has to have a good name. So those are the seven qualities. So I think that's interesting. That's, we don't, unfortunately, have a large...
I was going to say, that sort of limits the pool, exactly.
But we're working on it. All of us should be working to create this in our lives.
Well, speaking of that, I'm sure all of you, except maybe you, Ty, got a notice of these series of classes that I'm working on.
Yeah.